The Whole Health Cure with Dr. Sharon Berquist, the podcast that brings you inspiration and skills for living a healthy and fulfilled life.
Welcome to the Whole Health Cure podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Sharon Berquist. On this podcast, we explore the science and provide inspiration and skills for living your happiest, most fulfilling, and healthiest life. Today, we're in for a real treat. We're going to be talking about Native American cuisine. I'm joined by Dr. Lois Ellen Frank, a Santa Fe, New Mexico-based award-winning chef, author, Native foods historian, culinary anthropologist, and photographer. Lois Ellen has spent over 25 years documenting foods and lifeways of Native American tribes from the Southwest and regions throughout the Americas. This lengthy immersion in Native American communities culminated in her book, Foods of the Southwest Indian Nations, featuring traditional and contemporary recipes, which won her the James Beard Award in the Americana category. She has worked with world-renowned chefs, scientists, and academicians, and collaborated with them to publish more than 15 culinary posters, over 18 cookbooks, and a DVD and recipe booklet on the power to heal diabetes with the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine. Dr. Frank received her Master of Arts in Cultural Anthropology from the University of New Mexico in 2000, where she focused on the importance of corn as a common thread to all indigenous tribes throughout the Americas. She received her PhD at the University of New Mexico in 2011. She is also the chef and owner of Red Mesa Cuisine, LLC, a Native American catering company specializing in using ancestral Native American ingredients, all with a modern twist. Dr. Frank, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm very excited to be here.
And I'm very excited because Native American cuisine is definitely an area that I don't know much about, and I'm very excited to learn from you. Could you maybe tell us a little bit about the history of Native American cuisine?
Sure. I think Native American cuisine is probably one of the most misunderstood cuisines. And I use the word cuisine specifically to elevate it to a cuisine, a type of food equal to its European counterparts. If we look at the profession of cooking, you know, it's very Eurocentric, based on Escoffier and the French, and setting up a system for producing food in a restaurant setting. And if we deconstruct the word cuisine, it really means food that's prepared on a daily or regular basis using ingredients from a specific ecozone or region. So every culture in the world has a cuisine. And I think it's really important to sort of contextualize that. With that said, because Native people use a form of Native science, which I'm going to introduce a term that I use and several other Native American academics use, called TEK, which stands for Traditional Ecological Knowledge. And again, every culture in the world has TEK. So for instance, if I were a Native person living in Minnesota or parts of Wisconsin near the lakes, and I harvested wild rice, then I'm going to have a form of Native science surrounding that food as to when it grows, how I harvest it, how to build the canoe that goes on the lake, how to hit it onto the boat, how to winnow it, and then how to cook it. So there's a lot of science, there's a lot of processes that have to go through just for that one food. If I am a Northwest Coast tribe, then I'm going to know how to harvest an oyster or a salmon, something that's specific, how to use the flat cedar, how to plank smoke, which if I were the tribe from the Great Lake region, I could learn that. But innately, in my ancestral tradition, in my ancestral DNA, I don't know how to do that process because I don't have salmon in my particular ecozone. Does that sort of make sense?
And that makes a lot of sense. And do you mind my asking, what is your Native American heritage?
I am from the Kiowa Nation on my mom's side and Sephardic Jewish on my dad's side.
That should make for a very interesting TEK.
Yes. So I grew up multicultural, multilingual, multi-religion. I mean, just multi. And my mom always gave the analogy that as humans, we're all corn. And corn, if you look at a traditional medicine wheel, it has four colors on that medicine wheel: yellow, white, black, and red. And those are the four colors of corn. Those are the four races of man. And within that circle is everybody together on this one, we would say, turtle island or earth. And so we all have to learn to live together and coexist. And when you're more than one ethnicity, you're still corn. You're just speckled corn.
That's great. I think most people in this country are speckled corn.
Pretty much at this point, yep.
And how did your heritage and your culture growing up influence your culinary preferences and the types of foods that you like to prepare?
That's sort of a loaded question.
Yeah, I bet.
I definitely know my mom's Native side, but I also know the other side. And, there's sort of an ongoing joke that when I cook one, you get the other for free because it's in there and I can't get it out. So there's always a bonus, whether I'm doing Native or whether I'm doing the Jewish holidays. You're pretty much getting something for free. An addition.
Yeah, absolutely. And what are some of the traditional foods and cuisines of different Native American backgrounds?
So I'm going to just contextualize the history and talk a little bit about, how things evolve. So there's no one size fits all. There's no one food. If there were one food, it would be corn from as far north as it'll grow, from as far south as it'll grow. But when we get into some of the regions in northern Alaska and Canada, corn no longer grows. And when we go too far south, the same thing happens. So there's not one specific food that's going to fit all Native American nations. And we just have to be sort of conscious of that. But with that said, there are foods that Native people gave to the rest of the world, which I think there is just a lack of consciousness as to what those contributions were and how it changed the old world. So I focus a lot on the Magic Eight, and there are eight plants that inherently Native. So if we go back to 1491, before the encounter of Columbus and the Columbian Exchange, bringing ingredients from what was labeled the New World to the Old World. And I'm also very careful, history, everybody thinks it's objective, but of course, it's completely subjective. It's always who's telling the story. So if Native people got on boats and went to Europe, Europe would be the New World. But Europeans got on boats and came here. So from a European perspective, this is the New World. Right?
That's right.
So corn, beans, and squash, which actually are very common with a lot of tribes, and we call that the Three Sisters. That's actually an East Coast metaphor. And the Three Sisters are amazing in that they have almost every nutrient known to sustain human life. They form complete amino acid chain. They have fiber. They have vitamins A and C. So they're really, really important. We call it the Holy Trinity. And what's really fascinating in terms of permaculture and sustainability is how they grow is also completely sustainable. Corn needs nitrogen. Beans give nitrogen. Beans need a pole. Corn's a perfect pole. Squash has big leaves, shading the ground, preventing weed growth, and keeping moisture in. I mean, it's this perfect symbiotic relationship. So corn, bean, squash, chili, tomato, potato, vanilla, and cacao. So if we deconstruct that, we can say, oh, well, the Italians never had the tomato, and the Irish never had the potato, and half the British national dish, fish and chips, did not exist. There were no chilies in any Asian cuisine or East Indian curries. And the French had no confection using vanilla or chocolate. So these eight ingredients coming inherently from Native America, the Americas, went to the old world and changed the old world forever. So when we look at indigenous foods, we can say the Magic Eight, a big part of, we know that there were massive trade routes and that the trade routes extended much further than scientists originally thought. And archaeologists are still finding vessels with substances in them. For instance, in 2009, scientists at the University of New Mexico found a vessel in Chaco Canyon, New Mexico. In the vessel was theobromine. Theobromine's the marker for chocolate. It was radiocarbon dated using Western science, telling us chocolate was in Chaco Canyon almost about 1,200 to 1,500 years ago. So how did it get there? It was walked there. So that means chocolate from the south was walked and things were traded. They found abalone and salmon bones and turkey bones and wild rice, traces of quinoa, bison. So the diet was very diverse. And we have this pre-colonial, or what I say a pre-contact diet, that was diverse and very nutritious. And then there's this contact, and you know, many food academics, food historians, like to say that 1491, 1492, and 1493 is the years that the world began in terms of food, because there was so much happening and so many changes from the exchanges that were taking place that it changed everywhere, globally, everywhere. Just everything changed. And so we delineate the Italian tomato, which now is really, if you think about a fine weaving, it's woven into the fabric of Italian cuisine, and it can't be undone. Just can't be undone, right? The Irish potato can't be undone. Chilies in Asian food can't be undone. So we delineate these periods by saying there was a pre-contact or pre-colonial period with a first contact period. And here in America, for instance, I think a good example would be sheep with the Navajo Nation or the Navajo people. Or the Diné would be a more politically correct term. So as foods from the old world are introduced here, foods from here are introduced. And I think the biggest, most massive change in the Native diet is the introduction of domesticated animals and their byproducts. Native people ate no dairy. And for the most part, many, I'm not completely lactose intolerant, but I don't do well with dairy, don't tolerate dairy or lactose. And if you think about it, you can't milk a wild elk from a mommy elk that's lactating. You can try.
No, absolutely, yeah.
No dairy, so no chicken eggs, no cheese, no butter, no cream, no yogurt. So as domesticated animals came and were introduced into Native communities, so therein was the introduction of dairy. And many people to this day don't do well with dairy. So when we're looking at health and wellness and we're looking at this ancestral diet, dairy is not a big part of that. But if you look at mainstream America, it's, you know, now their cheese is in everything. You know, they're making pizzas with, you know, more. It's in the crust, you know, and Native Americans just can't process this food. And cheese is very high in fat and very high in a saturated fat, as we know, right? Cholesterol inducing. So Native people don't do well. So we have this pre-contact, then we have the first contact. In the case of Native people, I'm going to fast forward just for time purposes, hundreds of years, so we can go from 1492, the early 1500s, to let's go into the 1700s and 1800s. As more immigrants are coming to the United States, the U.S. government is opening the West, the railroad is being built, the Bureau of Indian Affairs is being established and formed, and Native people in many, many instances, and a lot of people have a little squirmish, difficult with this history, but nonetheless it is our history, are being forced off their ancestral homelands and relocated to reservations or what was called Indian country, which became Oklahoma, where 57 tribes, including my tribe, were relocated to. So we call this period. Now, if you're used to harvesting salmon and living off the land and knowing everything about that food, your TEK, your science, and you're relocated to somewhere that doesn't have that food, how do you survive? How do you know what to harvest or how to eat? You don't. You can learn it, but it takes time. So the government issued commodity foods, rations basically, to keep these native populations that had been forced off their ancestral lands to keep them alive. So lard, flour, sugar, coffee, and the infamous canned meat called Spam. Now, if we look at those foods, they're not, they don't make up a good diet. We tell our clients and our patrons, eat the rainbow, eat the rainbow, eat the rainbow. Lots of plants, lots of plants, lots of plants. You know, and we really encourage native people to eat wild game. So this period of this commodity foods rations is called the government issue period. And this is where we start to see the health disparities. So we're going back about 100 to 150 years, depending demographically on the tribe or the native community. For instance, the Navajo Nation just acknowledged the 150-year anniversary of what was called the Long Walk, which was the only time in the history of the United States where the government made 6,000, over 6,000, I think it was 6,800 people march hundreds of miles. They had burned all the fruit trees, killed all the livestock, made them walk to an area, issued them rations, and then a year and a half to 2 years in, decided they had made an error and marched back who was left. And that became the reservation now called the Navajo Nation. So, you know, there's historical trauma. There's definitely eating trauma. We have the boarding school period, Native people being ripped from their language base, their community base, put in very Western clothing, and then told to eat this pyramid, right? A Western diet. So we do see health disparities. And in terms of statistics, Native Americans have the number one rate of diabetes and the number one rate of obesity in the United States to date. And New Mexico has the number one death related to diabetes and obesity. And so we're failing. And this is where the fourth category comes in, which is called the new native. And the new native is really, I call it going back to the future. So we go back to the past. We learn what are the ancestral indigenous foods that were eaten by a specific community or demographic eco zone or area. And then we reintroduce those foods for health and wellness. And we're seeing weight loss, cholesterol loss, diabetes reversal with diet and diet alone. And it's phenomenal.
It really is phenomenal. So Lois Ellen, as you're saying this, you know, what's so striking to me is, you know, obviously a lot of people are familiar with the paleo diet and this idea that, you know, the first big change in our food supply came when we domesticated animals. And then the second, you know, around the same time of this government issue period was the industrialization of food, of the processing of fats, sugars, oils, that has led to the processed food. So the same, you know, lard, flour, sugar, and Spam has entered our grocery stores.
Yes.
And it's, you know, so fascinating that you see this spike in the health disparities with the introduction of these government-issued foods and the deviation from kind of the more natural endogenous foods and the new native, the work that you're doing to return back to the more ancestral eating patterns and the health reversal that you're seeing with that.
Right. So there's a term that we use called nutritional genocide. And I know that feels
that's very powerful.
Very powerful. But, you know, the issuing of those commodities was a form of nutritional genocide. And once we educated, there's a consciousness about what this is. So, you know, we can structure a modern diet and say, you know, okay, so I go to Sam's Club or I go somewhere to a store, a big box store, and I see 12 cinnamon buns and it's only cost $3.99. And my instinct kicks in and I think, oh, that's a bargain. But when we deconstruct that and we look at the ingredients and we look at the quality of the ingredients and we look at the sugar and we look at the fat and we say, is it a bargain? Because in 5 to 10 years, when I'm obese and I have type 2 diabetes and I can't walk and I can't feel my feet and I don't move much, is it a bargain? Is it really a bargain? And my response is no. I would rather spend $3.50 for one whole grain, dense, filled with fruit or carrots or raisins, whole grain muffin, and eat it slowly and not spike my blood sugar. And actually, even though you're spending more, that's the bargain, because you're not going to need a doctor for the rest of your life.
I love that way of thinking. I think, you know, we think very short term. We don't think about the downstream when we're factoring in the economic decisions. And restoring the ancestral heritage, you know, there's obviously so much history behind the traditions and culture. And, you know, oftentimes as populations become more mixed in ethnicities, it's easy to lose the cultural roots. How do you help preserve that with the groups that you work with?
So, you know, you can call it a diet, but really a diet is, it doesn't do justice to what we're doing. We're actually doing cultural preservation through food. We're doing food sovereignty. We're doing food sustainability. We're doing food as medicine. And if you look historically at many modern medicines, you're a doctor, they're based on organic compounds that come from nature. Right? So we can look at plants and we can look at herbs and we can look at food is our medicine. And so how do we reclaim this and use it in a very contemporary way? And, you know, I understand that people are on limited budgets and they work and time is an issue. And so there are other factors that maybe didn't exist in the past that we have to then incorporate into that. So I can slow cook a pot of beans and I can make beans 10 different ways the whole week and have lunch and maybe dinner for days. So I can do a hummus. I can make a stew. I can make a soup. I can make a puree. I can stuff it and put it on a sandwich. I mean, there's a million and one different ways. So we really look at some of the most sustainable and again, very heavy on the plants. And from the research that I've been exposed to and the doctors and nurse practitioners that I've worked with, the more plants, the better. And again, that eat the rainbow, the more colors on your plate. If you sit down and you've got brown and white on your plate, you're in trouble. You're in trouble. You need greens and reds and yellows and oranges and you can still have, you know, brown, which is a mushroom or meat or, you know, but you need all these other things to become a part of that plate, that power plate, that native plate, that ancestral diet. And so we do a lot with how to take very simple foods, in many cases inexpensive. What can you grow on your windowsill? Can you have a community garden? Can you be a part of that? And this is all a reclaiming, revitalizing of culture in addition to health and wellness. And I mean, you said it early on, you know, this is about a lifestyle. And once you do it, once you feel the health effects and you get healthy. I mean, I'll use myself as an example. I'm a chef and I taste a lot and I wasn't very good. I looked at my BMI and here I was promoting things and I wasn't following it exactly. I was a little lax. So I am on an ancestral diet. I do primarily plants. I'd say my ratio is about 90-10. So 90% plants, 10% protein from an animal source, which for me would be a bison or an elk or a venison, or a wild-caught piece of fish. Mm-hmm. Nothing farmed at all. I don't eat commercial meats at all, and I don't frequent fast food restaurants at all. So this, you know, 90-10 ratio, I lost 30 pounds. My A1C is now 4.5 and my BMI is about 22.5. So I feel like I'm the healthiest I've been in a really long time.
I think that's fabulous and fantastic that you're able to get that result on a primarily plant-based diet, which is really the theme in a lot of studies now done from different regions of the world for various health conditions, that this whole food plant-based diet really seems to be the healthiest dietary pattern.
Right.
Absolutely. And what are ways, or are there certain, like, you know, combinations, like you mentioned corn, beans, squash is the holy trinity for Native American foods. Are there any other ways that this whole food plant-based diet is uniquely Native American?
So it's not completely plant-based because Native people did traditionally hunt. I know you brought up paleo, which I find truthfully, personally, very problematic because I see people, if you wanted to do a true paleo diet, then you would spend the majority of your day out hunting.
And obviously there's a lot of debate of the ratios in that diet. And certainly right. We're never going to recreate it because we're not eating mammoth.
Right. So I'm that metaphor doesn't quite work for me in terms of health and wellness, but that's just me personally. But so Native, you know, corn, beans, and squash, very, very big. But I mean, if you look at, you know, the southern regions, there's cactus. And we know that cactus has a mucous membrane, and the mucous membrane regulates blood sugar. We can look at mesquite, which grows also certainly in New Mexico and parts of Arizona, Texas, Oklahoma. Again, a perfect food for regulating blood sugar, slow release, very nutty flavor, amazing. Chilies, the medicine in chilies, I think they're probably my favorite of all the Magic Eight, but they're full of vitamin A and full of vitamin C. They increase the heart rate, which then increases blood flow, which is why it's called a hot food. It may cause you to perspire. As you perspire, usually little beads on your forehead is the typical way. Then there's another trigger, which is the brain releasing an endorphin. So that's a feel good. So then the feel good is telling the body that if I feel good, I am well, therefore I can't get sick. It's topically sore aches, sore muscles, sore joints, arthritis. I mean, there are so many medicinal qualities in the chili that if people just started to incorporate small amounts of that one food, you know, you will build a tolerance over time. You are going to just bring in some amazing health effects. I think some studies are being worked on in terms of control management and working with nerves, but there's a lot happening around chilies, and so I eat them every day. I love them. And you don't have to burn your mouth to get the medicinal effect of that one food.
And is this all chilies or red chilies, any type in particular?
Well, chilies are based, chili is an indigenous word. If we go back, it comes from the Nahuatl speaking tribes of Mexico, where the chili originated. Oddly enough, chilies were migrated, so there's always been chilies in the wild because birds are the only warm-blooded animal that can't taste the heat in the capsicum. So they can eat the chilies, the fruit and the seeds, and then have a bird dropping, and then if that seed, the endosperm and the parts of the seed aren't damaged, then another chili can potentially grow. So that's how chilies originally spread. But if we look at the Scoville scale from 0 to 10, you can eat a very hot chili, maybe for instance, a habanero from the Caribbean, or you can eat a very mild chili like a poblano or an Anaheim and still get as much of the medicine as possible. I think chilies are confused, and we have a 500-year-old mistake of calling a chili a pepper because that's what Columbus named this fruit because he was in search of India and black pepper. So he went back to the queen and sort of manipulated the truth by saying he did find a chili, that pepper was called a chili pepper, pimiento de chili, which in fact, the species of chilies is not a pepper. It will never be a pepper, but it's a 500-year-old mistake that we're having trouble rectifying. Pepper is a subtropical tree with seeds, including black, white, pink, and green, that did not exist and never has been indigenous to the Americas. It's India and Asia, its origin.
That's really interesting.
So the chili, which I always say chili, is also called the chili pepper. Now, you also have to take into effect modern. So what about a bell pepper, which is sweet? So what has happened over time is a term called selective breeding, where you select qualities that you want from one generation, plant that, and keep selecting until you have something that might be quite different from its original ancestor. And I think the best way to sort of understand this would be to watch a cat or a dog show and say, oh, well, in a dog show, you've got an Irish wolfhound and a chihuahua, and they're both dogs, but they're completely different within the same species. And so chilies and bell peppers, the same thing. Certain qualities have been selected over time in some of these different species, like a Thai chili. Now people think it comes from Thailand, and it does now, but it didn't originate there. But it has adapted and adopted its environment and the flavors of that environment based on soil and rain and water. And so it has that flavor of that land. To try and put it very simply.
Yeah, that's very interesting. And in talking about the Magic Eight, how are ways that you incorporate it in Red Mesa cuisine, in the foods that you design in your restaurant and in catering?
So, a very common dish might be a Three Sisters stew or a Three Sisters taco. We do bison and we stuff that inside a roasted peeled chili. We do a sweet corn soup just with organic sweet corn. And I think the response is, oh my gosh, it's so sweet. What's in it? Well, a tiny bit of onion, garlic, and water, and good quality organic sweet corn. And that's it. And sometimes, people overcomplicate things. We do a peach sauce with just peaches and a tiny bit of agave. And again, everybody will taste something and say, well, what's in this? And a real peach harvested at the peak of its peach season, just like a delicious heirloom tomato, is perfect, nature's perfect way of flavor. And I am a big proponent that the healthier you eat, the more your taste buds and the craving for flavors will adapt to the naturalness of that ingredient. A peach, to me, when it's perfectly ripe, is a very sensual experience to eat.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. I think natural foods, just when you acquire the back to the taste buds of appreciating and savoring the flavors, it's amazing how much it kind of enlivens your taste buds, where I think a lot of processed foods tend to dull them.
Right. So and another rule of thumb, if you can't pronounce it, then you might want to think about eating it. You can't say it. Then you might want to not include that in your diet.
That's a great rule of thumb. Well, Lois Ellen, thank you so much for your time. Are there any other kind of words of advice or wisdom about a Native American cooking and using food as medicine that you'd like to share with our listeners?
Yes, actually, we were honored to be in a book fairly recently, and we wrote this little passionate, which I think encompasses a lot of who we are and what we do, and I'm just going to read these couple of sentences. We are passionate about cooking ancestral Native American ingredients and educating people on the intersection of both food and culture. I believe food has a story of how it nurtured our ancestors and sustained generations. Corn, beans, and squash, also called the Three Sisters, are connected to our culture as Native people. Many people are unaware of the contribution Native people have made to the foods we eat every day, including chilies, tomatoes, potatoes, vanilla, cacao, and the Three Sisters. When we prepare these foods, we revitalize everything associated with them. And when we feed people, we nurture them while still honoring our ancestors.
That's so well put. Thank you for sharing that. And thank you for all the work that you do maintaining the cultural heritage and using food as a way to sustain that culture. I think that that'll be something that many generations can pass on and enjoy.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been an honor and a pleasure.
Thank you. You take care.
The Whole Health Cure is brought to you by the Lifestyle Medicine and Wellness Center at Emory. For more information about wellness assessments, classes, and other resources, please visit our website. This material is copyrighted by Emory University.